It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
I can help the little guy fight against an automaker or a refrigerator manufacturer or anything that comes with a warranty, get their product fixed or get their money back.
Consumer Protection Attorney Patty Anderson talks about consumer warranties, when they apply, and how to enforce them. And during this week's question and answer session, we analyze the Virginia law that specifies what a former employer may and may not say about a former employee who has been fired from a job. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 96, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Creditors and debt collectors seek to recover on consumer debts through the use of litigation and arbitration. Based on its extensive analysis, the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, concludes that neither litigation nor arbitration currently provides adequate protection for consumers. In a 118-page report released last month, titled, Repairing a Broken System, Protecting Consumers in Debt Collection, Litigation, and Arbitration, the FTC states that the system for resolving disputes about consumer debts is broken. To fix the system, the FTC believes that federal and state governments, the debt collection industry, and other stakeholders should make a variety of significant reforms in litigation and arbitration so the system is both efficient and fair. Among the major concerns were filing suits based on insufficient evidence, failing to properly notify consumers of suits, the high prevalence of default judgments, improperly garnishing exempt funds from bank accounts, and suing or threatening to sue on time-barred debts. The report suggests specific state law reforms. Because very few consumers defend or otherwise participate in debt collection litigation, states should adopt measures to make it more likely that consumers will defend in litigation. Because complaints often do not contain sufficient information to allow consumers, in their answers, to admit or deny the allegations and assert affirmative defenses, states should require collectors to include more information about the debt in their complaints. Because consumers don't understand that a statute of limitations is an affirmative defense which may prevent a debt collector from getting a judgment, states should require debt collectors to prove that a debt is not time-barred and require debt collectors to include the date of default and the statute of limitations in their complaints to make it less likely that collectors will sue on time-barred debts. And finally, federal and state law should be changed to prevent the freezing of a specified amount in a bank account into which a consumer has deposited funds that are exempt from garnishment. The full report is available at www.ftc.gov/OS/2010/07/debtcollectionreport.pdf. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Ain't gonna let no hate. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answers to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Which two documents generally will give an employee legally enforceable rights? A, an employment contract, B, a union contract, or C, a personnel manual? The correct answers are A, an employment contract, and B, a union contract. These days, almost all personnel manuals have disclaimer language, saying the manual is advisory and only for guidance, and is not binding on the employer or enforceable by the employee. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time once again for the weekly question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
I'm Andrew, and I'm from Henrico County.
Welcome to the show, Andrew. What are we talking about this week?
Well, if I was let go by an employer through fraudulent means, it's unable for me to get a job here with one of the other local companies, and I was wondering, do I have any type of legal grounds to clear my name with the one company so that I'm able to gain employment with other companies here in the area?
Okay, well, Andrew, there's a very specific Virginia statute that deals with what's told about you by a former employer to another prospective employer, and I will read that to you, at least paraphrase it. It's Code of Virginia 40.1-27, and it says, "No person doing business in the Commonwealth, after having discharged any employee from service, shall willfully and maliciously prevent or attempt to prevent, by word or writing, directly or indirectly, such discharged person from obtaining employment with any other person. But this section shall not be construed as prohibiting any person from giving on application from any other person a truthful statement of the reason for such discharge." Translating that into plain English, your former employer cannot willfully or maliciously try to keep you from getting another job, but they are allowed to state a truthful statement of the reason why you were discharged. Now, of course, often truth is in the eye of the beholder, but they do have to be truthful. So, for example, if you were to apply for unemployment compensation and the final decision of the Virginia Employment Commission was that you were discharged but not for work-related misconduct, then your former employer could not say that you were denied unemployment compensation because of work-related misconduct, because that's simply not a truthful statement. It gets a little bit dicier if the former employer were to say, well, we discharged you for something that we regarded as work-related misconduct, even though the Virginia Employment Commission didn't regard it that way. The problem really in a situation like that is proving what your former employer is saying to other people about you. Because really, a lot of people want to, quote, clear their record. But really, the former employer is allowed to keep its personnel records pretty much as they want. And if they want to say internally, you were discharged for work-related misconduct, that's their business, nobody else's. What is somebody else's business, particularly your business, is what they're saying about you to other people. And finding that out is often real difficult, because typically you apply for a job, you get turned down, you never get told the reasons. If you do get unemployment compensation and it was proved that it was not work-related misconduct, certainly that would be helpful to put on an application. Is that helpful to you?
Very, very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you for being on the show. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the law office of Patty Anderson. She is a consumer law attorney fighting for consumers and specializing in lemon law, warranty issues, and consumer fraud. Welcome to the show, Patty.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Marty.
We're going to be talking today about consumer warranties, and would you start by telling us what is a consumer warranty?
A warranty is a promise by the seller or the manufacturer that a product is going to behave the way it should. So there are express warranties. They can be oral or written, but what you really want is to have a written express warranty that details what the warranty covers and for how long. Once a manufacturer or a seller gives you an express written warranty, then they also come under a very magical federal statute called the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. And that protects consumers much more so than just the warranty itself, because it says that if you have an ongoing problem that the manufacturer can't fix that should be covered by the warranty, then you can force them to fix it, or you can sue them, and you can negotiate with them and perhaps even turn the product back in. But you can also get your attorney fees paid. And of course, that's how I make my living. I can help the little guy fight against an automaker or refrigerator manufacturer or anything that comes with a warranty, get their product fixed or get their money back.
Now, I understand there are various types of express warranties. There are full warranties and there are limited warranties. Could you describe for our listeners the difference between those types of warranties?
Well, full warranties and limited warranties should call themselves what they are. A limited warranty needs to say that it's limited, or will be presumed to be a full warranty. And a full warranty is what you might have with your car from the manufacturer for a limited period of time, although even those are going to be limited because they're not going to cover normal wear and tear on your brakes, on your tires, that kind of thing. So what's most often seen in a consumer product is a limited warranty. And you want to read those. The manufacturer or the seller is required to give you those before you actually sign the transaction. And that almost never happens. And then people almost never actually read the warranty. So, for instance, I had a limited warranty on a motorcycle case in which the manufacturer put in their express written warranty that it didn't cover bolts. No, it didn't cover bolts and brackets. Well, of course, what happened to my client? He's purchased this custom-ordered motorcycle, and the first time he rides it, bolts fall off, and the side mirror falls off, and the taillights fall off. You know, and they try to say, gee, that's too bad. So that's the other way that this federal act can come in, because there's also implied warranties.
And I wanted to talk about that. I gather that if you get an express warranty under the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, you also get the implied warranties. Tell our listeners, what is an implied warranty?
Well, implied warranties come in two stripes. You have an implied warranty of merchantability and an implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose. For the consumer, what that means is that if you get a written warranty, then the manufacturer cannot disclaim those implied warranties that are in the common law, that are part of our statutes in Virginia and almost every state, so that they'll try to say, well, we've given you this warranty and it only covers the engine or the fan on a refrigerator or something. But actually, if they've given you an express written warranty, then the refrigerator, it's presumed that they give you a warranty that also says the refrigerator is going to keep food cold. You know, it's going to work the way it normally is expected to work. If you buy a product for a particular purpose and you let someone know that, then it will also be implied by the law that the seller is giving you a warranty, is promising you that the product will work for that purpose. So sometimes people will go in and say, I need a truck that can haul you know, 5,000 pound ATV or something. And if the dealer says, yes, we've got just the truck for you, here it is, and you buy it, and then it can't do that, that's a warranty violation, and you can go against the dealership or the manufacturer.
So to go back to the example you gave about the motorcycle, that the limited warranty didn't cover the bolts, if in fact the bolts were defective or just didn't do the job, would that be an example of something that may not be covered by an express warranty, but would be arguably covered by the implied warranty of merchantability?
It is exactly, that's exactly right. And that's what people need to know, because sometimes when you're trying to handle your own issues, and of course that's your first step, is to go back to the person who sold you this product and say, you know, I've got this problem. You have to give them an opportunity to fix it. If the seller then points the warranty to you, and first of all, they didn't point that out when you bought the product, that, gee, the warranty doesn't cover bolts, then they point that out to you and say, you know, too bad, that's your problem. If a consumer doesn't know that the implied warranties are also in place, they may believe that, and they may go away.
Now, what if you have a situation where there is no express warranty, either in writing or spoken? Do you still get the implied warranties?
On some things, like an area that I do most of my work in automobiles, the seller can only disclaim the implied warranties by selling the car as is. And to do that, there's an as is language on the front of the buyer's order, of the original contract. And it has to be in a certain size, it has to be, you know, conspicuous on the page, and it has to be signed by the person. Now, if you buy a car as is, they can sell you a pile of sheet metal as is. So, you know, that's something to be very cautious about. They're wanting to sell it to you as is, probably because they either haven't checked it out and they're not making you any promises that it's even going to make it down the road. So if you're going to buy a car as is, you need to buy it. You need to have it checked out by a mechanic before you sign anything.
And I assume also take it for a test drive?
Oh, certainly do that, yes. Take it for a test drive. If the dealer is limiting your test drive, wants you to test drive a different vehicle because this one is, you know, being polished or something, you can't do that. I wouldn't recommend buying a used car as is, really under any circumstances. Do you buy it as is from an individual who's selling it out of the newspaper, that's fine. And I've gotten good cars that way. My husband's bought cars that way, you know. But you have to get a good feeling. You have to trust your instincts about people. And it still is a good idea to get it checked out by a mechanic.
So as I understand, if nothing at all is said about the implied warranties, you do get them, that they have to be affirmatively disclaimed or disowned by the dealer who is selling you whatever it is they're selling you.
They have to be affirmatively disclaimed on a motor vehicle contract, on any other contract that does have any kind of a warranty. They have to be disclaimed. They can give you a written warranty and also not disclaim the implied warranties, but they can limit them in duration. So say, for instance, you get something that's not really expected to last very long, because implied warranties will last 4 years from the date of purchase. But let's say you buy something like a brake job, and the repair shop might give you a written warranty for a year on your brakes, and that's pretty reasonable. But if they put on that written warranty that they're limiting the duration of the implied warranties to that 1 year, then they are in fact limited to 1 year. And that makes sense, because brakes aren't necessarily going to last 4 years.
So how should consumers start when they have a warranty problem? Take us through the steps, you know, one by one until they end up in your office. What should they be doing?
Well, first of all, I would say even before you have a warranty problem, protect yourself from warranty problems by doing a couple of things. One is, if you're making a major purchase, have someone with you, another adult, who can hear what the person's telling you. What kind of promises is the person making? Especially if you're going to buy that pickup truck that you need to haul firewood or whatever, have someone with you, take notes. You have contemporaneous notes about what the salesperson says to you, who the person is. And, you know, just being a little bit preventative like that goes a long way. I have people come in and say, well, he told me I had 30-day warranty, and if anything happened, he would fix it for me. I say, well, do you have that in writing? Well, no. Do you have someone who was with you who heard that too? No. Well, you bought the car as is, and that I'm not, it's not a case I'm going to take. Even though you might, you know, if they really said that, you might be in the right, but it's going to be hard to win. So also, read your documents that you're going to be purchasing something. Unfortunately, a big trend these days is to have an arbitration clause in most documents. And what that means is, and it will even say in there, you're giving up your right to a trial. You have to go through an arbitrator. And often an arbitrator, they might name an arbitrator, they might just say arbitration. They might name one of the major arbitration organizations or leave that blank. But the arbitrator is going to be someone that works with that dealership or that manufacturer over and over again. And that's where their bread is buttered. So arbitration decisions are most often, overwhelmingly in fact, in favor of the business. So you know, when you see that on there, you need to scratch it out. And the thing that I hear, I've heard it lately, my own husband is trying to buy a truck. Gee, that's printed on the form. It's printed on the form, we can't scratch it out. And that includes, you know, dealers will often include often outrageous processing fee. You know, I've seen $2.99, I've seen up to $4.99, processing and handling fee or administrative fee. Oh, and gee, we can't scratch that out because it's printed on the form. Well, of course, you just make them take that much out of the price of the product. And that's the same with arbitration. The first man you come to, the first person, I should say, you come to, once you've made the decision to buy the product, is probably not going to have the authority to let you scratch out the arbitration clause. And the more people who scratch these things out or say, I'm going to walk away if you don't let me scratch this out, the more consumers will really be taking charge of our own situations and our own purchasing power.
And it sounds like we need to have you back on the show later to talk about consumer arbitration, but I think we're out of time for this. We have been talking with Patty Anderson. She is an attorney who does consumer law, fighting for consumers, and specializing in lemon law, warranty issues, and consumer fraud. Thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. Which two protective orders can be issued only after the alleged abuser has received notice and an opportunity for a hearing? A 72-hour emergency protective order, B, a 15-day preliminary protective order, or C, a 2-year permanent protective order. If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, Every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. 2 years after the Wall Street meltdown, the foreclosure crisis continues unabated. Join us next week when foreclosure prevention attorney Karen Kennedy discusses forensic mortgage loan and securitization audits and the surprising foreclosure defenses that result from them. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.